From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The federal government is formally proposing to roll back Obama-era fuel mileage standards for the next decade. The Trump administration wants average fuel efficiency requirements frozen at 2020 levels. The current standard calls for 50 miles a gallon by 2025, and California officials say they'll defeat the move in court. We'll hear their strategy after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific start to your day. Coming up, L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald makes his regular visit. We'll find out why his department isn't pursuing body cams right now, as so many other big city agencies are. First, the Trump administration, as you just heard on NPR News, made it official this morning. The U.S. EPA and National Highway Traffic Safety Administration are calling for fuel mileage standards to be frozen at year 2020 levels. And that would roll back aggressive standards agreed to by California and the Obama administration. They called for average fuel economy of more than 50 miles a gallon by the year 2025. Now, California has been able to set more aggressive fuel standards under a federal Clean Air Act waiver. That waiver would be rescinded under today's proposal. California Attorney General Javier Becerra is holding a news conference right now in response to this morning's announcement, but I spoke with him a half hour ago and asked him about the state's strategy.
We're going to do what we said at the very beginning. We're going to take it on at every turn and make sure that California does not go back to the old days of polluting and leaving dirty air for our kids. It's not an option for us. For our economy, for our health, and for our environment, we have to continue to get better, not worse, when it comes to what we throw into the air. And so we're prepared to fight. We hope that during this comment period that we're afforded by the agencies, that the agencies will get some sense knocked into them, and we'll be able to continue forward with the clean car standards that we have in place.
Would you be willing to negotiate a compromise with the Trump administration where the standards might be softened somewhat by California in exchange for continuing to have the waiver allowing California to set the more stringent standards?
I think Governor Brown and Mary Nichols, the head of the California Air Resources Board, have answered that on several occasions, saying, of course, we're willing to sit down. And they have, on occasions, had the conversations with the administration, but it doesn't seem like the administration has really been listening. And so while we're always ready to sit down and have conversation, just the way we did 8 years ago when we sat down and actually reached this historic agreement to have national standards, we're ready to do it again. But conversations have to be meaningful. They have to be real.
The argument that's made by many in the Trump administration is the Clean Air Act was never designed or intended to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. This is really about air pollution, not the release of CO2 relative to climate change. What's your response to using the Clean Air Act for this specific purpose?
Larry, under the Clean Air Act, the Environmental Protection Agency has a statutory obligation to reduce harmful pollution from vehicles, period. And under the Energy Policy Conservation Act, NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration, has an obligation to set CAFE standards, fuel efficiency standards, at what are called, and this is from the statute, maximum feasible average fuel economy levels. They must try to pursue the maximum feasible average fuel economy for our vehicles. In neither case, whether it's EPA or NHTSA, are they doing their job?
California has been required for having these more stringent standards to operate under a waiver from federal authority. So that would seem to indicate there is federal authority, the fact that there's been a need for a waiver. legally, why wouldn't the federal government be able to say, we're no longer going to offer the waiver to California? There's going to be one national standard that we set.
Well, a little history here. Remember, probably before you and I were actually saying words, California was already in the process of regulating air pollution. We've been at this for more than 50 years in California. We've been at this longer than the Clean Air Act has been around, and we've been at this longer than the EPA has been around to try to regulate pollution. And that's why for close to five decades, California has received waivers from the federal government, the only state to receive these waivers from the federal government, to continue to push forward, because it's clear to you and me and everyone else who lives here that we must do everything to diminish pollution in California because of our natural resources, our environment, our ecosystem. And so we've always been granted these waivers. We've never had a waiver rejected. In fact, the federal government has never rescinded a waiver. And there's a basis in law for the waivers. And so now they're in place in these standards. And so for the administration to simply say that they want to undo them flies in the face of not just the facts and the law, but of the long history that has been used by California to rely on to be able to take actions, and of course our industries as well.
So is your argument, because the waiver has been in place so long, therefore it's de facto codified? Is that the legal argument you're making?
Because it's been around so long, it's also become part of our legal and regulatory architecture. So it's not just because it's been around. It's not just tradition that holds our laws and regulations in place. It's far more. It's the facts, it's the science, and it's the actions that have been taken. And obviously California, our people, and not just California, but some 13 other states, in fact, close to half of the population lives in states that follow California standards. And as a result, we've been relying on these waivers, all of us, to be able to move forward. And that's why zero emission vehicles are so popular in California, because it's not only a good thing for the environment, but we have to do these things in order to control pollution.
State Attorney General Javier Becerra with us on Air Talk. What specific legal action are you going to file?
Well, we've already filed an action in court previously, when the administration started to send salvos out that they were changing or they were going to try to change the standards. And so that litigation is ongoing. We're briefing, providing briefs in that case as we speak. And now with this latest introduction of this proposal by the administration, we now have an opportunity to comment under the law. We'll take full advantage of that opportunity to comment. I hope that after comments are received, the administration will recognize the error of its ways and keep in place these standards. If they choose not to, again, we'll see where they end up. But we believe we have a very strong case to fight in court to keep these national standards that were put in place through the negotiations that occurred between California and the federal government, to provide every state, not just California, these higher standards to help us move towards cleaner vehicles.
But in the meantime, the new federal standards will go into place. Is that correct, pending some sort of a stay issued by a court?
That's right. The Trump administration can't on its own simply stop cavalierly laws and regulations from moving forward. They've tried, and we've knocked them to the ground on several occasions in court, because they've tried to stall or delay implementation of certain regulations. So hopefully they won't continue to violate the law, and they'll instead comply with it until it's clear what standards would be in place through any change that's proposed.
Final question. It seems like this is really ripe to eventually get to the U.S. Supreme Court, because there are so many different jurisdictional issues here and competing arguments made. Would you be at all surprised if that's where it ends up, at the high court?
I hope not. I think most people recognize what's going on these days. 18 fires raging right now in California, 9 people dead so far, including 4 firefighters, more than 1,500 homes and structures burned so far. And that's before our fire season actually gets going. Something's going on, not just in California, but throughout the country, where we're seeing these dangerous fires. We're seeing flooding, mudslides, torrential rains that have devastated the state and our neighborhoods. Larry, the earth is not flat. And
isn't that a separate issue as to whether this is smart or not for the federal government to do it versus whether they have the ability legally to do it?
Well, the federal government can try to change its regulations, but it has to have a basis to do so, because there was a basis to institute the regulations in the first place. So there's always you're never static. You're always trying to make things better, and that's what the law requires, whether it's the Clean Air Act or other laws, to make things better. So you can change the standards you have, but you have to change them to make things better. The Trump administration is trying to change the rules to make things worse.
So their argument that this that their changes, the relief from the higher CAFE standards, would make automobiles comparatively cheaper, therefore people would buy newer vehicles with more safety features, there'd be fewer highway accidents and injuries. You don't buy that argument.
I'm willing to see what they call facts, but think of it this way. If people were rejecting these higher and cleaner standards for our vehicles, why is it that last year, with the records that we have, I think they're for 2016, we had record sales of automobiles in the United States of America. More automobiles were purchased by Americans in 2016 than any other year in our history. It surpassed the previous record in 2015. And so when you purchase, I think it was somewhere around 17.5 million vehicles, you're liking something about those vehicles, even though they become cleaner and cleaner every year over these last several decades. And so I think we don't only have the facts on our side and the science on our side. I think we have the people of this country on our side.
Attorney General Javier Becerra, thanks so much for talking with us this morning on Air Talk.
Thanks, Larry.
Also with us, Director of Policy and Federal Affairs at the American Energy Alliance, Kenny Stein. Mr. Stein, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What about the argument we just heard from California's Attorney General that this has been longstanding, the waiver, the negotiations with the Obama administration? All of this has paved the way for standards to be established, and that the Trump administration has not presented a justification for changing those standards.
Well, the longstanding waiver that California has had has not been for greenhouse gases. Going back, we're talking about 50 years ago when we first started allowing these waivers. It was for other pollutants, the ozone, smog-forming particulates, that sort of thing. The greenhouse gas issue is very, very recent. In fact, California only first applied for that waiver in the 2000s. And the decision on that waiver actually never was truly fully litigated. It was short-circuited, basically, when the Obama administration came in, and Bush administration had previously rejected a waiver for greenhouse gases from tailpipe emissions. The Obama administration reconsidered that and granted it. So the actual underlying legal issues here truly have not been litigated. And the Trump administration's justification, their primary justification, is that the CAFE program, which is the fuel efficiency standards, is separate from the Clean Air Act waiver that we've been discussing, that the Attorney General was discussing. And under the CAFE program, there's no opportunity for a waiver. The federal government is the only venue for fuel efficiency standards, and it can only be set at the federal level.
So this would have to be litigated, in your view, because you said a court deciding it was short-circuited. So you just see this as an issue that's going to have to be decided by the courts. You think it likely it goes to the top?
Oh, ultimately, yes. There were two district courts that started to consider the rejection of the waiver that the Bush administration did. But that was, again, those cases were dismissed because the Obama administration changed tack, and there was no longer anything to fight about. So the key is going to be the interaction between the Clean Air Act and the CAFE standards, the EPCA that the Attorney General also mentioned. And the key, it's going to boil down to what the words "related to" mean, because under the CAFE standards law, all state level regulations on fuel efficiency or regulations related to fuel efficiency are preempted, full stop, no waiver, no opportunity. So the question is, are greenhouse gas emissions limitations from tailpipes, are those related to fuel efficiency standards? And that's an open legal question, and it's probably going to have to be decided by the Supreme Court.
We're talking with Kenny Stein, joining us from the think tank American Energy Alliance, a think tank which is devoted to free market principles. We'll also talk with an attorney for Earth Justice about their thoughts on what would happen if the standards are frozen at the mileage standards set for 2020. And we'll get a sense of what the automotive industry has to say about this as well. What might the effect be on car makers? Would they be making separate types of vehicles or not? And would they, in fact, choose not to move forward with higher fuel efficiency if it's not mandated by the feds? We'll get into it in just one more minute on Air Talk. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonnell, with us in just a few minutes. But right now, the big news from the Trump administration, the U.S. EPA, and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, calling for 60 days of public comment on a proposal to freeze the negotiated fuel mileage standards that the Obama administration and states like California negotiated to freeze the level at year 2020 standards. Now, that would mean that the standards that would otherwise go into effect by 2025 of over 50 miles a gallon, automakers wouldn't have to meet that standard. With us to talk about that aspect from Automobile Magazine, Editor-in-Chief Mike Floyd. Thank you, Mike, for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So how do automakers respond to this?
Well, I think they're of two minds about it. The first mind is, well, in 2012, they weren't exactly thrilled about the Obama administration's policies, but they weren't in any position to argue with it, certainly with GM and Fiat Chrysler being bailed out. I think they've always contended that they were going to have a lot of trouble making these standards, but they're doing it. And the other thing about it, too, is, you know, when you talk about a global economy and global vehicle sales, you know, China's the biggest market in the world. They are a leader in battery electric technology, and they understand that they are going to have to do a lot of things to bring up the fuel efficiency and to really change what vehicles are about globally. So, and they also do these things like 5 to 10 years in advance. So I think really they know that they got to get way more efficient with their vehicles. It's really just about how quickly that's going to be.
Sales of all electric vehicles, have those reached the levels anticipated under the CAFE standards?
No, I mean, the electric vehicle market is still infinitesimal. There's been a lot of hype around Tesla, and there's, you know, people are saying, okay, you know, there's interest there. The market may be shifting. But right now, the EV market is very, very small. That being said, every major automaker on the planet is building all manner of hybridized and all-electric vehicles. GM just announced not too long ago that they're going to have 23 hybrid or all-electric vehicles by 2023. So, again, they are already been planning for this kind of stuff for dramatically increased fuel efficiency standards. So I think they're okay with freezing it for a while, because right now so much of the market is SUVs and trucks that, you know, they're less efficient and they're having a lot more trouble kind of getting those heavier vehicles more efficient. But I think they know that they have to get that way.
Well, is much of this driven by gasoline prices? The price at the pump goes up significantly. Presumably that would put the curbs on SUV and truck sales, and people would look for some of these new, more efficient vehicles in place of that. But, you know, automakers can't control that variable.
Well, yeah. I mean, look what happened in 2008 when gas prices spiked to four, sometimes $5 a gallon. I had people, you know, left and right saying, like, how can I get rid of my SUV? Like, they're running around with their hair on fire. And I think that's, you know, that could easily happen at some point. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen 10 years from now. Gas prices could go, you know, up to $10, $15 a gallon somehow, and everyone would be doing the same thing. So, I think the age of the internal combustion engine is nearing a completion, probably within 20 to 30 years. I don't think there's anybody that I've talked to in the automotive industry that doesn't believe that. So it's just, again, it's kind of a matter of like how quickly it really happens.
We're talking with Mike Floyd, the editor-in-chief of El Segundo-based Automobile Magazine, also with us from the environmental law organization Earth Justice, attorney Adrian Martinez. Adrian, good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me.
So your thoughts on this, particularly in light of what Mike Floyd was just saying, that people within the industry think all electric is coming. It's just a matter of how quickly it's coming. Now, what's Earth Justice's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think the proposal today will pump the brakes on that movement. And this administration has shown time and time again that it has a nostalgia for destructive and older technologies like coal and other fuels that are harmful for our health and the planet. And I think this is just yet another example of this administration trying to promote those types of fuels like oil. You know, I think the big news here is that the administration is picking a big fight with California. I mean, it comes on the heels of we've had 44 straight violations of 44 straight days of violating clean air standards in Los Angeles region. And I don't think people in Los Angeles are going to take too kindly to rolling back the ability to protect our air.
Well, that probably doesn't matter too much to the Trump administration because there are comparatively few voters here. But on the matter of the federal government's legal ability to do this, if the federal government can effectively make the case that the Clean Air Act does not cover CO2 emissions related to greenhouse gas and global warming, that this is about other air pollution affecting health, then, you know, what? How is the state going to be able to respond to that?
Well, the federal government lost that argument in the Massachusetts versus EPA case that went all the way up to Supreme Court. So it's pretty clear that the Clean Air Act can cover CO2 emissions. I mean, the issue here is whether this 2007 law somehow interferes with the ability of the Clean Air Act. And I think what the proposal today does is it's a very big government proposal, which is kind of ironic coming from this administration, trying to rewrite the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act is very clear. There are three standards you need to meet to get a waiver and to allow California to set more aggressive standards. And California met it. And this is kind of unprecedented territory where the federal government's trying to take away the clean air benefits and the fuel savings that California had been promised.
Mm. Adrian Martinez of Earth Justice, Kenny Stein of the American Energy Alliance, you clearly see this very differently as to what the court precedent is on the Clean Air Act and CO2.
Well, I don't disagree with what he said. But I just think this exact issue isn't affected by Massachusetts EPA. This isn't the question here in this proposal. Isn't what the Clean Air Act says. It's how that interacts with the CAFE standards law, and that's the Trump administration is using the CAFE standards preemption as their justification for preventing state-based regulation on these issues.
All right.
That's an open question.
All right. I thank you all for being with us. Kenny Stein, American Energy Alliance, Adrian Martinez of Earth Justice, Mike Floyd of Automobile Magazine, and we heard earlier this hour from Javier Becerra, California's Attorney General. You can share your comments about the Trump administration's announcement this morning, 60-day comment period beginning on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org, where our comments are always being taken. Coming up in just a minute, L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonnell. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, reports that Google is working on a search engine that would be employed in China and would be subject to Chinese government censorship. That reportedly has even employees in Google upset about what their company is contemplating. We'll talk about the business ethics of that a little bit later. But right now, our attention to one of the nation's largest law enforcement agencies, the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. Sheriff Jim McDonnell joins us. Sheriff, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Larry. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's talk first about the body camera matter. The L.A. Times editorializing yesterday or the day before, I can't remember which, about, you know, what's the delay? Why isn't the Sheriff's Department following LAPD and what other major departments are doing, getting deputies with body cameras so that we can see some of these controversial interactions?
Sure. You know, I'm a big supporter of the body cam program. We piloted it for 2 years and we're impressed with the results. When it comes right down to it, though, it's a case of priorities. It is expensive to put in place a body camera program and to do it right. And if we want to be as transparent as we can, then we need to be able to have the infrastructure in place that will allow us to be able to provide for discovery. When somebody's stopped for any reason on the street, there's an interaction, they're arrested, there's a use of force, there's a lawsuit. Any of those reasons and so many more, people potentially are going to want to get a copy of that video, and they have a right to that. So when they put in their requests, I want to be able to meet that and have people in place who are trained to be able to capture the appropriate amount of video, to be able to go in and pixelate uninvolved third parties when that's appropriate in the case, and to be able to provide for them the piece of video that they need. And so in order to be able to do all of that, we do not have people in place currently that are trained to do that, that are available to do those kind of jobs. So we'd have to hire up to be able to staff that group, and the estimates were that a little over 200 people would be involved for an organization the size of the LASD. And so while people talk about the cost of the body camera, that's the least of it. The server space, the cloud space is another consideration, but really the true cost comes in the
personnel.
Ability to be able to provide. Right.
But your former department, LAPD, so how are they able to do this? Is there, you know, is just a bigger allocation of funds specifically for this purpose? Well, how are they doing it and you're having a harder time?
Yeah, they have a bigger section to deal with discovery than the Sheriff's Department has had. The Sheriff's Department is an incredibly lean organization. From a taxpayer standpoint, a tremendous value for the taxpayer's dollar. But from the standpoint of actually doing the job and being able to provide the services we'd like to be able to provide, it is extremely lean organization. I'll give you just an example. We both, LAPD and LASD, have roughly 9,500 or so sworn officers and deputies. We police the same number of people directly, 4 million as LAPD does, indirectly over 10 million people countywide, 10 times the real estate as the city of LA, 470 versus 4,700. And then in addition to doing what LAPD does from a responsibility standpoint, we also do the jails, the courts, the colleges, the hospitals, the parks, search and rescue, and a third of MTA. So we stretch those that personnel out over all of those specialties, each of which, or most of which, are the largest of their kind in the country. So, again, a very lean organization, one that we, you know, we have good people who do a tough job exceptionally well. But when it comes to adding responsibilities, given the already, you know, substantive issues we have as it relates to overtime, where having people work, which I know you want to touch on too, our ability to be able to ask and get more of people, there's only so many hours in a day, and they are working pretty hard.
We'll continue talking about the budget challenges of the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. We'll come back with County Sheriff Jim McDonnell. But first time time for a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald with us. We're getting our periodic update from the sheriff about one of the largest law enforcement departments in the United States. We're talking about the budget challenges. He just described the square mileage, number of people within the jurisdiction of the sheriff's department, and how with body cameras, coming up with the money for that isn't feasible at this point. So what would change, Sheriff McDonald, to enable you to do it? Would be a specific allocation just for body cams, a general budget increase? What would it take?
Yeah, it would be a specific allocation toward body cameras because, you know, when I look at the priorities we have in the organization, our number one priority right now is recruitment, being able to build for the next generation. We've had a lot of challenges as to the number of personnel we have available, what we've been budgeted for over the years. And in today's environment, for the last decade, just the issue of being able to effectively recruit people to come into the profession of policing has become much, much more difficult. So for every 100 people who apply to the LA County Sheriff's Department, 4 will make it to the academy, 3 will make it through the academy. I don't really know of another profession that has a 97% washout rate. So we need to cast the net wide, but we also need to be strategic in where we do that and how we do that to be able to get the best and the brightest on board to serve the public for years to come.
Now, this relates then to the high number of hours of overtime that it required right now because of all the vacancies?
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, when you look at where we are today, it just didn't happen overnight. When going back 8 years, we've had over 500 sworn vacancies in the department. So I inherited those vacancies. And in addition to that, we've expanded by over 800 positions in the last 5 years to fix some of the issues we had in the jails and other programs, but we're making progress. Today, I can say that we've reduced our vacancies by half with this August deputy recruit class that's coming up. And looking at the amount of people that we hire, that's a challenge that most organizations will never face. We hire more people in a year than most police agencies have on board. So when I look at where we are in the academy structure, when the next class begins on August 6th, we will have 322 LASD recruits in the academy. So that's very promising. We've got full classes. We're working hard to be able to get the right people in the class. But in July of 2015, the department had just over 1,200 deputy vacancies, and we're very close today to cutting that in half when the next academy class graduates in August. So we're on track. We're working very hard at it. But certainly, I always make a recruitment pitch that if anybody knows somebody out there who would make a good deputy candidate, please turn them onto our website. And it is a great job for the right person.
Do you think that the rules are too stringent and that the 97% washout rate is higher than it should be? Or you think that the profession simply requires that and there's no way of changing that?
You know, it's been that way for some time. LAPD has similar numbers. There are departments around the country where they don't face those kind of numbers and have different standards. But we've seen over the years what happens when you relax your standards. You end up paying for it one way or another. And any time that somebody doesn't do the right thing and we should have caught something in the background that would have precluded us from hiring them, that's a shot to our credibility, to our reputation, to our image, and particularly to the public that we serve. And we want to be able to maintain the highest standard that we possibly can.
We've seen in the entertainment industry and in sports where social media postings have come back to haunt
right.
people with racist language
right.
in tweets and that sort of thing. How deeply does the department get into the social media past of applicants?
Well, certainly we dig into that. You know, anything that's a part of an individual's background, we'll try and find out who this person is. What do they bring into the table? And if there are things in the background, such as you mentioned, that would be disqualifiers, we want to be able to know about those. If we don't find them directly, we hope that we can through interviews that are done of friends, family, and acquaintances over the years. And so it is today a very complex environment where there are a lot of variables that weigh in on somebody's qualifications for a position. But people need to be aware that they're being looked at, and if they take a position on something or come out with something that's racist, sexist, homophobic, or, you know, disrespectful, that we're going to weigh that, look at it, and it could well be a disqualifier.
Could someone rehabilitate from that? I mean, if they came and said, you know, look, I held these beliefs or I posted these things to be shocking. I don't hold these. But I mean, is that something the department consider, or is the liability too great? Once it's out there associated with an individual, can you not take that risk to hire that person?
You know, it would be a big risk. It would depend what the comments were. It would depend, you know, not only on, you know, how bad they were, but also what the topics were that they were addressing. And is it something that reasonably was said in jest, or is it something that shows, you know, hateful feelings deep down inside the person? And those are the kind of things that, you know, while somebody may talk a good game, can they really get rid of those kind of feelings if that's what they put out there at one point? So we would weigh everything, take a look at the person, the whole person, what have they done since that time, much like anything that anybody's done that they may think is a disqualifier. If enough time has gone by, it was not a serious event when it did occur, and somebody has shown increasing maturity, increasing responsibility, been taken on in the subsequent period, then that's something we weigh heavily.
L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald with us, our regular visit on Air Talk. Speaking of hateful language or conduct, the L.A. County Board of Supervisors voting to review the Sheriff Department protocols for reporting and investigating hate crimes. You take issue with that?
Oh, not at all. You know what? We take hate crimes very seriously, hate crimes and hate incidents. When I look at our numbers recently here in LAESD jurisdiction for 2017, we were down 31% and down 50% from 2016. So we do a very strong analysis of anything that potentially could be a hate crime. We review that those crimes daily, all the hate crimes and hate incidents within our jurisdiction. Each of our stations, 23 stations, have a designated hate crime liaison. The department tracks all hate crimes and hate incidents and through statistical coding on all of our reports. And so we make contact with all of the victims of hate crimes by one of our department members. And these cases are all investigated promptly and thoroughly. Where appropriate, then we refer them to the DA's office for potential filing. I've had the opportunity for the last, I would say, probably 15 years to as well sit on the Anti-Defamation League's Law Enforcement Advisory Committee that focuses on hate crime and hate incidents and acts of bigotry and bias. And we bring together law enforcement officials from throughout the Southern California area to be able to share information on what we see in trends, patterns, or issues like that. So we take it very seriously here in Southern California and are proud of the job that we do.
It seems, though, that the Board of Supervisors, part of the directive here is a belief that hate crimes may be underreported and that law enforcement agencies may not be fully reporting all the incidents that they really could. Do you feel confident that the Sheriff's Department currently is accurately logging hate crimes in the county?
Certainly, there's always a possibility that people are hesitant to come forward. We do it the best job we can in educating the community. We work closely with communities that are most frequently victimized by hate crimes. We have great relationships out there. So when I look at that, I am confident that we're doing a good job reaching out to people. But I also am aware that there's the potential that people are hesitant to come forward to the police to report a hate crime. And we're trying to bridge that gap as best we can and use third parties where we can, that if somebody's a victim of a crime and they're comfortable going to some organization and that organization then in turn can communicate with us, we can facilitate the investigation as well. So there's a number of ways to be able to do it, but it's certainly, if there's underreporting, it's certainly not due to any lack of trying on our part to be able to get people to come forward and to take very seriously the crime that is reported and investigated to the fullest.
Coming up, a defense attorney in Los Angeles claims that matching tattoos are indication of a clique within the sheriff's department, a potential gang within the sheriff's department that might be abusing people that are inmates in custody. We'll talk about that allegation, what the department is doing to try and determine if such a clique exists. L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald with us back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald with us. We're talking about the biggest issues his department is facing, and some of them, of course, that are across law enforcement nationally. If you have a question of the sheriff, You can post it on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. You can tweet it at AirTalk, or you can call 866-893-5722. A local defense attorney alleging that there's evidence of matching tattoos among some sheriff's deputies. There may be evidence of a clique within the jail system. This is something that historically has been a problem for the sheriff's department, with groups of alleged rogue sheriffs acting out of policy with the department. Sheriff McDonald, what are you doing in response to this allegation?
Oh, we're taking it very seriously. The perception, even if it's only that, affects the the professionalism in the eyes of the people that we serve of the department. It's a public trust and a credibility issue. So there is an administrative investigation process that we have where there are allegations of misconduct. That process is used. We filter a criminal investigation separated from an administrative internal investigation. And on top of that, then we look for issues in the department that need to be addressed in maybe another way. And for over a year now, I've been working with the Office of Inspector General and our county council on the issue of tattoos, and looking at that issue to see, is there a tie-in between behavior and performance of people who may share a tattoo? As we know in our society today, the prevalence of tattoos is like we've never seen it before. But our concern is with the tattoos and being reflective of a subgroup or a subculture within the organization. And if that subculture doesn't share the values of the mission of the organization, then that's where we have problems. And certainly the LASD has had issues going back to the 70s with tattoos being tied into groups within the organization. And back to 92, the Colts report raised allegations about the existence of subgroups engaged in unprofessional or improper conduct. We saw that when I sat on the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence, also similar allegations in 2012, and both patrol stations and in custody. And so what my goal is to be able to work with our partners at the IG's office, at County Council, to bring in experts and bring in the union as well, to be able to look at this issue, do a comprehensive study, and to be able to come away hopefully with some findings on what we're dealing with and come up with the best thinking on how to resolve these longstanding issues.
When recruits join the department, what are they told about cliques, groups, initiations, common tattoos? Are they spoken to about this?
In the academy, their instructors speak to them about a number of different things, and among those would be that issue. And certainly, when you look at this particular case that you mentioned, they're in a deposition, and they were asked by an attorney about a tattoo, and they're under oath. They show that, and then what does that tattoo do for their credibility? What does it do for the organization's credibility? And can that be used then against them for the rest of their career? It's an issue about their potential effectiveness as a peace officer. If that the body art that they've chosen to put on themselves is something that they're going to hear about every time they testify, then was that a wise move? From a tactical standpoint, you put yourself in a position of disadvantage in doing that, and certainly the potential cases you handle, the department you represent, and more importantly, the community that we all protect.
What are the psychological factors that you think are at work in the formation of cliques? I don't know whether other departments deal with this, but why would a deputy or an officer want to join a particular subgroup, go through an initiation process? What's the payoff in that?
Belonging, I would guess, and that's what we want to look at in this study we're doing, to really find out what are their purpose, what behavior is associated with being a member. Are they secret or exclusive? Do they require certain conduct to become a member? And do they condone improper behavior? So all of those things are of primary concern to us. The tattoo is emblematic potentially of something else. We want to find out what that something else is and then hold people accountable for their behavior and their performance.
What about potential of conflict within a work group when you have some members who would potentially be part of the clique, others who wouldn't, right. wouldn't even be invited perhaps,
right.
and might, you know, maybe not want to be a part of it or refuse membership or be upset they weren't invited to join.
Sure.
How do you deal with the group dynamics of that?
Well, certainly it's a morale issue and it's an issue of effectiveness. And if you have subgroups within an organization like a police organization where everybody relies on each other for backup and support, we can't afford to have that. And it affects not only our effectiveness, but the safety of the deputies out there doing a very difficult job, as well as our overall ability to provide the level of service that the community deserves. So it's something that is very much a concern for us. It's something that is very nuanced. We want to be able to protect the rights of all involved, but at the same time, maintain the credibility of the people that we serve.
And again, do other departments deal with it? Because I've, you know, working so many years in L.A., it seems I've only encountered this right. with the sheriff's department historically.
Yeah. No, there are tattoos out there. There are station tattoos, unit tattoos, and police agencies across America and military units across the nation as well. And I'm sure many, many other groups.
You think maybe this comes in part from the military?
It could potentially. I think anytime you have a group of people that are very cohesive, that work together in a way where they put their lives on the line as well, that you're going to see behavior where they want to be able to show that they're part of something bigger than themselves. And, you know, you look at a Marine Corps tattoo or another military tattoo and people wear that proudly. But you don't have to do something particularly other than be a member of the organization to get that
tattoo. So you wouldn't mind if they had that feeling about the sheriff's department.
Right.
You don't want that allegiance to a clique.
Exactly. Exactly. The esprit de corps that comes from being part of something bigger than yourselves can be very, very positive, particularly in doing a job like this. It's where it becomes you focus and identify with maybe a part of the organization that is not in line with the culture or the mission of the organization. Then it becomes dysfunctional.
Just want to close very briefly. $2.2 billion replacement for Men's Central Jail. You satisfied with what that's going to offer in mental health and health care services and the kind of custodial arrangements you think are suitable?
Well, I'm happy we're moving forward with it, and that is a big investment, $2.2 billion. But it'll give us a state-of-the-art treatment facility for our growing inmate population. It'll also house a new inmate reception center, which will include a community reentry resource center. And the population there will include our high observation housing inmates, both male and female, as well as moderate observation housing. So those that are pretty seriously and very seriously mentally ill will be treated there. When you look at the inmate reception center, we book in an average of 350 inmates daily at our inmate reception center, and an additional almost 1,200 inmates get processed through the IRC to go to and from court. 80% of the inmates that come into our IRC require additional services after their initial medical triage, which includes medical provider examinations and assessment by the mental health professional. When I look at the number of people we have in our custody today who have serious mental health problems, it's 31% of our daily average inmate population. On an average day, we have 17,000 people in our custody, so almost 5,200 of them have fairly serious
mental health problems. So arguably, this would likely be the replacement still, the largest mental health facility in the country.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Sheriff Jim McDonald.
Thank
Good
you,
to have you with
sure.
us. Back with more. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going extremely well thus far. Just want to remind you, coming up a little bit later, we'll talk about controversy in Orange County, state of California, giving the go-ahead for needle exchange sites. And that's got Orange County cities in an uproar because they're concerned that having drug addicts exchanging needles in locations within their cities will create public safety and health problems. We'll talk about that. But first, we turn our attention to Google, where the publication The Intercept announced that Google apparently is working on a censored search engine for China. This several years after Google pulled out of China because of the government's efforts there to try and keep search results censored and certain things the government doesn't want residents there to see that were uniformly blocked. They continue to be blocked under Chinese search engines. engines that are there currently. But the ethical issues that this raises are significant, and it has, according to The Intercept and The New York Times, created conflict within the company itself. With us is Daisuke Wakabayashi, reporter for The New York Times, covering technology. Dai, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, first of all, what's the response you've been able to uncover from Google employees about the company reportedly working on this?
Yeah. I mean, Google's employee base is notorious for having heated debates about just about everything from food to, more weighty issues. And certainly this is one thing that has sparked a lot of debate within the company. There's a, there's a contingent who believe that, that creating a censored search engine for China is kind of a human rights issue. It's a violation of kind of some of the principles that the company laid out in pulling out of China in 2010. But there is also another wing who believes that, not doing this and not getting back into China is not helping Chinese consumers get access to the information that a good search engine can provide. And so there is a pretty furious debate going on right now within the company on all of its kind of internal messaging platforms.
And what do other U.S. companies do when it comes to China if there are limitations that the authoritarian government wants to put on it? Are there companies that have played ball for a long time with China who've gone a different road than what Google has?
Not really. I mean, I don't think you can really operate in China unless you're willing to play by the government's rules. Apple is a good example of this. They will, filter out apps in their app store that have, that the government doesn't like, whether it's apps that will talk about Tibet or Tiananmen Square or any other kind of banned topics. I think the New York Times app is also banned in China, and so it will not show up in the Apple China App Store. And so, it's this kind of trade-off, right, where you have this huge market, huge opportunity, huge economic opportunity, but in order to access it, you have to play by the government's rules. And so, a lot of the companies will make the justification that we abide by local government rules, and this is one of the rules that you have to censor these things.
Has that been controversial within Apple among its employees, or is it just unthinkable to them that you wouldn't sell Apple products in China because of the government's terms?
I think there's probably some people who don't like it, there's a kind of a corporate culture that is different in all these companies. I think Apple is just generally tends to be more pragmatic and perhaps about how it views those situations. Google, from its earliest days, sort of holds itself to a higher ethos, or at least tends to think of itself as holding itself to a higher ethos. They famously came up with the "Don't be evil" slogan, and for years they've kind of believed that what they're doing is in the best interest of the world. And so once you start putting yourself up against that kind of ideal, if there are things that come up that challenge their own view of themselves, then there's a lot of debate that goes on.
Well, and of course, Google is involved in products at the very least indirectly, but it is search engine ideas are so much at the core of it, and there's the notion of freedom that at least is somewhat embedded in the idea of searching. So it's a little different, I guess, than Apple, which is essentially a product company.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, Apple will say, look, if we give people iPhones, what they choose to do with those iPhones is kind of on them. Search is a free service where the promise is that you will find what you are looking for. And if you are starting to say, you can find what you're looking for as long as it's not X, Y, and Z that is banned by the government. So that, I think the promise of, you're right, that the promise of the product or the service is quite different.
We're talking with Daisuke Wakabayashi, New York Times reporter. He's based in San Francisco. And talking about this report, first in The Intercept, that Google is developing a search engine for Chinese use that would comply with all the Chinese government requirements, essentially be a censored search engine. But even if Google came up with this, what are the prospects the Chinese government would say, okay, Google, come on in?
Yeah, I think that's the open question, right? I think a lot of people got very excited about the prospect that this means Google's going back to China. And I would tell everyone, you know, hold your horses, because I think Facebook has been trying for a long time now to also, you know, make their way into the Chinese market, and they've made overtures, both kind of a charm offensive and probably concessions to the government, and yet they're still not there. And so, you know, a lot of this will be whether the Chinese government feels comfortable or feels there's a need for Google in their country. And I think that that is a big unanswered question. For Google, you know, if the Chinese government does say, okay, yeah, you know, we're interested, come on in, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that as well, because then you are expected to, you know, anticipate in some ways the things that the censors, you know, will flag. And so you will have to have the you know, here in the U.S., when something slips by Google's kind of screening for whether it's misinformation or stuff like that, you know, a lot of times the company can say, oh, you know, our algorithm didn't catch that. I don't think that justification is going to fly with the Chinese government. And so it is a big responsibility if they do decide to go back to China, and, you know, and if the Chinese government welcomes back.
Dai, is there one dominant search engine currently in China, or is it pretty fractured?
Yes, there's a dominant one called Baidu, and they openly censor. They don't, you know, make it clear, you know, they don't make it explicit that they do, but everyone knows that it is a censored search engine.
We're talking with Dai Wakabayashi, reporter for The New York Times. Also with us, professor of business ethics at the University of Minnesota, also teaches at the university's MBA program in China, Ian Maitland. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Not at all, Larry.
What do you think the ethics are if this is an accurate report that Google is developing this censored search engine?
Well, as Daisuke has brought out, it brings up lots of fascinating issues. I mean, Google did declare war on China, as it were, back in 2010, and it lost. It thought that its search engine was going to be appealing enough to China that they would cut it some slack. Things didn't work out that way. So now they're going back in, sort of cap in hand. I think that Daisuke hit the nail on the head. I think there is quite legitimate reason to argue that providing the a search engine in China will give a lot of Chinese access to far more information and resources. At the same time, the price that Google has to pay is that it's got to use all of the, it's got to censor its search engine. I wouldn't discount the sincerity of their claim that there definitely is some big advantages for China. I would also say that you shouldn't overlook the commercial considerations. This is the biggest internet market in the world, 720 million users. And I think that any company has to understand that the shareholders are probably going to fire you if you don't consider the strategic implications of allowing your rivals to, you know, build up their strength in the largest market in the world and then project that strength into your own market.
But this is where ethics come in, right? I mean, your business ethicist, and it's not just all about what your shareholders want you to do or pressure from the board. It's about what's the morally right thing to do, even if it costs you money.
You are absolutely right. The problem there is that if you always do the morally right thing and others don't, then good firms finish last. And so you have what political scientists and economists call a collective action problem here. And I think that you really do need to have leadership from your government. And in particularly since we're in troubled times in our relations with China, it's possible that Donald Trump should be thinking hard about whether these sorts of limitations on U.S. companies might not be part of a package by which China will liberalize access to its markets. Risk is that it will be those firms that are the least scrupulous that take over. If you do put this burden on Google and exempt those other companies. So it's a very tricky problem.
University of Minnesota business ethicist Professor Ian Maitland with us, who also teaches at his university's MBA program in China. Professor, when you're in China and you're there for an extended period teaching, are you able to work around the censorship of the internet? Does VPN work to get you around it, or are you just subject to the limitations when you're there?
Oh, it's a good question. Let me clarify something. It tends to be a sort of flyby course. So I teach, it's an executive MBA program, and I teach 2 weekends.
Oh, okay.
But no, you're quite right. A VPN used to work. It doesn't seem to work any longer. And I think that the Chinese people understand that self-censorship is a key to survival and to making success of their career. So generally, there are topics that I think implicitly agreed are off the subject. They're not on the table in the classroom, which is a great shame. China is a wonderful place, wonderful people, but there are these constraints that do limit my enjoyment of those teaching.
Yeah, I'll bet. Daisuke Wakabayashi, The New York Times, are there other ways, if VPN no longer is workable, to get around the limitations of the Chinese internet, are there other ways that people have been able to get beyond those restrictions?
I honestly think that people have learned to live with it. There are local, just like how we've come to depend on Google and Facebook for, a lot of our, internet life. There are local competitors, whether it's Baidu or Tencent or Alibaba, who have basically risen up and created services that I think by and large satisfy the consumer base of that country. And so I don't feel like one of the things that I thought was interesting that we heard from some of the Chinese consumers is that, there's a generation of consumers who have grown up without Google, right? And so for us, Google has become synonymous with search. But, if Google is going to go back to China, it's going to have to convince people that we are a search engine, and kind of do a branding campaign that I don't think that they've ever really had to do since its early days. And so I'm not sure that there's a huge sense that that Chinese consumers feel like they're missing out.
Yeah. Well, and whenever there's censorship, of course, it doesn't affect most people. The effect is in a comparatively small group that often would have its voice magnified otherwise if there weren't the censorship in place. Dai Wakabayashi, thank you for being with us. Ian Maitland, professor, thank you for joining us as well. You can share your comments about the ethics of Google reportedly in development of a search engine for China that would be subject to all Chinese government limitations and censorship. Coming up, we'll take a look at a controversial approval that's been given for Orange County cities to have needle exchange sites for drug addicts. Well, those cities aren't happy about it, nor is Orange County. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Earlier this week, the California Department of Public Health approved a mobile needle exchange program in four Orange County cities, the Costa Mesa, Anaheim, Orange, and Santa Ana. And those cities aren't happy about the move. You know, supporters argue that this really is a public health benefit, that it prevents the spread of HIV and hepatitis C, that it keeps addicts safer and the general public. But opponents say that the needle exchange programs attract public health and safety problems. Joining us is Alicia Robinson, reporter for the Orange County Register, who's been following the needle exchange story. Alicia, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
There's been a needle exchange program in Santa Ana, right there at the county complex there. Why is Santa Ana turned against this?
Well, just the very brief backstory is Orange County never had a needle exchange program until 2016, when a nonprofit group that included some medical students at UC Irvine got together and started setting up in the Santa Ana Civic Center once a week and giving out clean needles to injection drug users. However, back in January, the city of Santa Ana denied them a permit to continue operating after city workers basically said they found hundreds of discarded syringes in and around the Civic Center, including in the public library and the book stacks. And, you know, some workers were actually pricked by needles, and the city basically had to bear the cost of cleaning those up and disposing of them safely.
Well, it's funny because needle exchange programs, at least one of the big selling points is that you don't have all the discarded needles as a part of it because you're exchanging it. What happened in Santa Ana?
Well, I think part of the issue was when the needle exchange first started in Santa Ana, rather than just doing a one-for-one clean needle for a dirty one exchange, the program was actually giving out a larger number of needles than they were taking in. And I think that was because they were only there once a week, and so they thought people would need more, you know, needles than they could get within that time. So because there were so many more clean needles going out than dirty ones that were being collected, that was part of the problem. I think there was also some concern about there weren't enough places for people to dispose of them properly, and there wasn't enough. You know, people from the program said that they went around and did sweeps to clean them up, but apparently that wasn't happening often enough.
I saw on the news wires that Costa Mesa is holding I'm not sure if it's a rally or what you'd call it at noon to try and raise publicity against this. You know, Alicia, specifically what they're planning?
You know, I don't. I did get an alert about that the Councilman Alan Mansoor has organized this protest. It looks like it's going to be, it's at noon today. It looks like it's going to be near the site where the proposed mobile needle exchange would be stopping.
All right. We're talking with Alicia Robinson, Orange County Register, also with us from the California chapter of the Drug Policy Alliance, the organization's acting director, Laura Thomas. Ms. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you.
First, can you address Santa Ana's negative experience with that needle exchange program and the concerns that raised?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we have to consider syringe access programs in the context in which they operate. And what I know about the Orange County needle exchange program, they were operating there because there were already a number of homeless people in the area. You know, generally, syringe access works best when it's taken to the locations where people need it the most, like most services. And so, you know, I think people sometimes misunderstand the sort of cause and effect of, you know, the syringe access program is there because people are using drugs, not that people are using drugs there because of syringe access.
But it sounds like the city officials their perception was the number of needles increased dramatically. So could that be a problem of how the exchange program was implemented?
No, it sounds like what I know about the Orange County Needle Exchange Program, they were using best practices. They were founded by a group of medical students from UC Irvine who spent a lot of time learning about how syringe access programs operate. They're operating within the guidelines set by the State Department of Public Health. We know that it's best practice to make sure that people have the syringes that they need so that they can have a sterile syringe for each injection event. That's the recommendation from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And when syringe access programs are so limited in the number of hours that they can operate, they're going to end up following those best practices and giving out syringes that people will need for a week's worth of injections, for example.
I'd love to hear from Orange County residents. If you're a resident, particularly of one of these four major cities in the county where the Mobile Needle Exchange Program has been approved by the state of California, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We're talking about Anaheim, Costa Mesa, Santa Ana, and the city of Orange. Also with us, Orange County Supervisor Andrew Doe is the chairman of the Board of Supervisors. His first district includes Santa Ana, Garden Grove, and Westminster. Supervisor Doe, thank you for being with us.
Hello, Larry.
So how far do you think supervisors should go to try and fight this?
I think we should take the lead in the county, and hopefully the cities will join us in our effort to turn back this approval. And I think it should be studied more closely and to be more fully developed before it's implemented.
So you don't think the state of California did its due diligence before issuing the permits?
Right. If you look at the law that allows this kind of permit to begin with, it does require that the locations be narrowly targeted to areas there is a significant increase in infection. We have seen no data supporting the four locations that have been approved. And we also find that the program, for the same reason that Alicia mentioned earlier, there is absolutely no provision for the proper disposal of used syringes. And so this is a program that is only half developed. And so that's the reason why you would have this kind of random discarding of used syringes around the city. And the reason that the county is involved is, at the end of the day, we are responsible for the public health in the county, and we run the public library system also. And that's where a lot of the problem are attracted, because people go there, they actually do use the bathrooms and they use the privacy of the bathroom in order to do a lot of the things we're talking about.
And is that where these needle exchange sites are being talked about at libraries in the four cities?
No, it's not that, but the thing is, when you infuse that number, the excessive number of needles into the community with no proper way of disposing of them, that's where you have people just throwing them randomly all over the place.
But, okay, and so you're saying the needle exchange can't be the place of disposing because people get the needles, then they leave, then they drop them in the street elsewhere?
That's right. And if you look at the location, you should really look up on a map. Like in Anaheim, the square block that they have been approved to dispense the needles, within a half a mile of that location, there are 6 to 8 schools, depending on whether you go a quarter to a half a mile out. 8 schools within surrounding that block. And then when you are allowing only 4 out of 32 cities in the county to have this kind of ability to get free needles, what are you doing is you're attracting users from other parts of the county into these four cities. You're concentrating the users in a small geographic area that will intensify then the problem even more.
We're talking with Andrew Doe, Orange County Supervisor. His district is the first, includes Santa Ana, Westminster, and Garden Grove, those central Orange County communities. He's the chairman of the board. Also with us from the Drug Policy Alliance, which supports needle exchange programs, seeing it as a benefit to public health and safety, Laura Thomas. If you want to weigh in, particularly as an Orange County resident in one of the four cities involved, we're at 866-893-KPECC. 866-893-5722. Ms. Thomas, how have other communities that have needle exchange, how have they dealt with these concerns about needle disposal as well as about being a potential magnet for addicts?
Yeah, I think, one thing, it may seem sort of counterintuitive, but being able to provide more syringe access services in more locations and more hours during the week is one of the good ways to address the syringe disposal issue so that people aren't holding on to their syringes all week for the one time when they can bring them back. Another way to address this is make sure that you're partnering with law enforcement and that law enforcement really understands that it's legal for people to have syringes on them. A lot of times people are afraid of harassment, or they've had experiences of being harassed or arrested by law enforcement. So they don't want to have the syringes on them. So then they're looking for other places to dispose of them. So you want to make sure that you can partner with law enforcement. And third is things like disposal kiosks, making it easy for people. Make sure that all of the pharmacies in the area will accept used syringes as they're supposed to. And making sure that everyone's got proper disposal boxes. You know, I've been a volunteer with the Syringe Access Program here in San Francisco for about 25 years. And, you know, my experience is that people who use drugs are really happy to bring their syringes back. They want to bring them back. They want to get them off the street. Many people take personal pride in the number of syringes that they pick up off the street. So encouraging those efforts and recognizing the work that's done, that those are some of the things that have been effective in our communities.
You mentioned San Francisco, where this has been going on for a while, but the city still has a problem with needles discarded on the street and the public health problems that raises. Is that just in your view that there aren't enough of these exchange centers, or, you know, what are the reasons that's a growing problem in San Francisco at the same time they're exchange centers?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's sort of two things going on here. One is that the housing crisis here has pushed more and more people out onto the street who previously either were living in encampments out of view or were living in housing. And so those individuals are now using their drugs on the street, and they're increasingly displaced and disconnected from community. So the fact that people are using drugs on the street is more a function of our housing crisis than anything else. But San Francisco is really trying some innovative approaches, the most exciting one of which is going to be supervised consumption services once we get those up and running, which will give people a place to inject their drugs indoors and then leave their syringes there. And so they won't be using library bathrooms, for example.
Yeah, I doubt we would see that very soon in Orange County. Supervisor Andrew Doe, you wouldn't be welcoming that, I'm presuming.
No, Larry. And I want to address some of the points.
Real briefly, yeah.
Yes, I think the fact that the advocate is citing, you know, proper disposal illustrate the point we've been making, which is this program right now has none of that built in. Okay, so that's one. And the idea that users are proud in bringing used needles back, well, our experience in Santa Ana, we were receptive to it for a year and a half, but the anecdotal evidence or real-life evidence shows that that's not the case.
People All right.
throw them out randomly.
Supervisor Andrew Doe, thank you for being with us. Laura Thomas of the Drug Policy Alliance, thank you. And from the Orange County Register, reporter Alicia Robinson has been closely following the story about the state of California's approval of four sites for needle exchanges in Orange County cities. It's Air Talk on 89.3. Coming up, we talk about one of the most famous roads in the world. It's got a huge LA connection. We'll talk about that right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's.
If you ever plan to motor west, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Bobby Troup, the man who composed that song, best known for his years starring the TV show Emergency, but prior to being an actor, he's a songwriter, a pianist, and singer. Troup wrote the song after coming west on old Route 66 with his wife. She challenged him to come up with a song, and she actually came up with the popular rhymes there that made this a hit. Ultimately, for Nat King Cole, we'll hear that version a little bit later, but we're talking about Route 66 because of its designation of one of those American resources to be most endangered. The National Historic Trails list is where Route 66 resides, and the National Trust for Historic Preservation wants to see the route from Chicago to L.A. preserved. They have made a trek across Route 66, arriving today in Los Angeles. They've got an event tonight at Clifton's, and then will be at Mel's in Santa Monica tomorrow, where it ends at the Pacific. With us, Jason Clement, Director of Marketing for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Jason, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So share with us about this trip, which has sort of been, you know, it's been a PR campaign, get attention again for Route 66. How has this gone, stopping in communities across the country?
It's been great, and you have no idea how many times I've heard that song this month.
I'll bet.
On July 2nd, we launched our road trip from Chicago, where the route begins in downtown Chicago. And for 5 weeks, we've been traveling the Mother Road, stopping over 200 times at communities up and down the route to spread awareness about Route 66 and the National Historic Trail designation that we're trying to pass, but also to tell the story of Route 66 through the eyes of a younger generation, with a variety of different storytellers who have joined us throughout the route. Every week, we've had a new roadie, is what we're calling them, join us and really help us share the story of Route 66 through a new lens so that it can reach an audience of millions, really, online. It has been great. We're really happy to be in LA. It's been a really long journey, but we've met some truly remarkable people along the way.
I wanted to ask you about the demographics. Having done the trip with my family 3 years ago from LA to Chicago, I was struck by how many international tourists from, I'm sure you saw this as well, from Europe and from Asia, and comparatively few younger Americans, just the demographic you mentioned that you're trying to raise attention. Why is Route 66 seemingly more popular with younger travelers abroad than with younger Americans?
Well, that's a great point, and something on day one in Illinois that I, in my first day, I met someone from Australia, from China, from the UK, and from Thailand within the span of a couple hours. And you're right. I think for those people, Route 66 has been kind of evangelized overseas as this quintessential American road trip. And people come here trying to capture that essence of our country. It was actually one of the more interesting people I met along the way at the world's largest covered wagon in Lincoln, Illinois. We met a couple that had to be in their 20s from the UK who were dedicating their entire summer to exploring America on Route 66, but not necessarily to go to all the roadside attractions and do all the kitschy stuff. They wanted to come to the United States to see for themselves what our country's like today based on what they see in the news. And I thought that was really interesting, their desire to get on the open road and experience America firsthand. And I just thought, I actually found that very endearing.
Well, and it's so different than the coastal America that we see, you know, typically depicted in media, because much of this, even though much of it parallels interstates, you are getting into many smaller communities, ones that were bypassed by the interstate, and a very different way of life. I was struck by how many of the small towns have abandoned downtown areas. Maybe you've got, you know, one bank that the agriculture folks are using, and then everybody else goes to these sort of hub communities that typically have universities. The little downtowns, those shopping districts, long, long gone. They're there physically, but they're desiccated.
Absolutely. And, you know, so many of those communities exist because Route 66 once went through them. And this whole kind of economy of heritage tourism back then in its heyday popped up to do. I mean, it's funny. I find it very, endearing. all the ways that people try and get you to stop on Route 66, the gimmicks, the roadside attractions.
How many museums did you – I couldn't believe the number of Route 66 museums.
Like 200. and they all, though, have a very unique spin on the route. So no two are the same. But it really is a point of pride for a lot of these communities. And that's a huge part of the National Historic Trail designation that we're trying to pass, is that those communities, a lot of them, as you said, are struggling. And what they need is more assistance, technical assistance to help preserve their towns and their roadside attractions, more actual dollars to help that happen, but also just interpretation and helping them develop a plan to bring tourists back. You know, in Illinois, again, to go back to the first week where I launched the trip, you have one town like Pontiac, which has its Route 66 game down. Mm-hmm. beautiful museums, excellent mural program, really happening downtown. And then you have other towns like Lincoln, where there's abandoned storefronts everywhere. And they're like a couple hours apart, if that. So it really does run the gamut of expertise these communities have to really capitalize on 66 and to make it profitable for them again.
It's a great point you make. So much of it is location or even state by state. I think of Angel Delgadillo in Seligman, Arizona, starting this off with his brother and kind of getting Arizona's game going, getting the attention of other. Well, if he can do that in Arizona, we can, do stuff in Oklahoma or mm-hmm. other places. But there isn't really a sort of national coordination with it. What would the designation actually bring, though? Was it federal dollars? What grants? What would happen?
So the National Historic Trail designation, first of all, it's permanent. And that's very important because right now Route 66 is protected, in air quotes, by the Route 66 Corridor Preservation Program. That's actually sunsetting in 2019, which is why we added it to our endangered list. That, of course, is a temporary program, and it has been reauthorized several times since 2001 when it was started. We see the trail designation as a much more holistic tool because it's permanent. We'll never have to deal with it sunsetting. And it carries over a lot of the same resources that the Corridor Preservation Program has. So one is technical assistance, again, telling and teaching these communities how something can be saved and restored. Giving them the inspiration, as you mentioned, to do it, like some of the great Pontiacs of Route 66 have done. There is a grant program that has actually helped save hundreds of roadside attractions and buildings along the way that would be continued. But one of the things really that would help is just the elevation of Route 66 as a National Historic Trail under the purview of the National Park Service. It would join the National Park System like so many of the places that you like to go to, including a lot of really other important trails. The California Trail, which of course brought many people here for the Gold Rush. The Selma to Montgomery Trail in Alabama, which of course was MLK's Walk to Freedom. So it's just the fact that it would be elevated and kind of recognized as this actual treasure that many people think it is.
We're talking with the National Trust for Historic Preservation's marketing campaign director, Jason Clement, kicking off that campaign the beginning of last month from Chicago, coming all the way to Los Angeles, where they close out this week that month-plus long trek to raise attention for endangered Route 66. If you've taken the route, all or part of it, you have a favorite place you'd want to share, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. One of my favorite places was in Illinois. I actually drank my coffee out of their mug this morning. I'll tell you about that. We'll be back in 1 minute.
If you ever plan to motor west, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66.
The hit version of Bobby Troup's Route 66, the great Nat King Cole singing the song. We're talking about the history of the highway that brought millions of people across the United States from the heartland, Illinois, all the way to California. Maybe your family has a story of Route 66. My grandparents would talk often about, after getting married in Michigan, coming out in one of those camper mobiles where you could actually stop along the side of the road road or in a camper park, the car would actually fold open on the side and you'd have tent camping along the highway. That's what my grandparents on their honeymoon used to come out on Route 66 to Los Angeles, where my grandfather was born and raised. Love to hear your thoughts about Route 66 if you join all or part of it. Of course, it goes through so many Southern California cities like Santa Monica and Pasadena and portions of central Los Angeles out through the San Gabriel Valley along Foothill Boulevard. We're talking about the National Trust for Historic Preservation's efforts to make sure that Route 66 is preserved in perpetuity. 866-893-KPCC. So I told you, one of my favorite places, I have so many, but the Ariston Cafe in Litchfield is this great small-town community cafe that has a Greek-American family that owns it. They've owned it for years, and they've totally adapted to the changing clientele from when you had thousands of people that came right by the door when it was Route 66, the main thoroughfare, to now where it's a well off of the main interstate, and yet they've become a real center of their community. The Ariston Cafe, Litchfield, Illinois. We hung out with the owners for, I think, 2 hours after finishing lunch, just hearing from them about the history of the restaurant, what it means in their community. 866-893-KPCC. Blair in the Hollywood Hills, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, hi. I moved out to California with my family as a five-year-old from Minnesota, pulling a boat behind us, and we drove most of the old Route 66. Great memories. I salute your effort. I have a memory of the Best Western, I think, outside of Gallup, New Mexico, and I remember the motels along the route, and some of them just really kind of neat places that each had their own kind of kitschy theme or whatever, and it's just a great memory, and I want to thank you for your efforts, and that's all.
All right. Thanks so much, Blair. I appreciate it. Yeah, Gallup, a place that really existed as the payroll center for the railroad, for the Santa Fe Railroad. The paymaster's name was actually Gallup. That's how this community got its name. And then, of course, becoming a roadside stop for people traveling on Route 66. I did want to ask you about when people of color were on the road, because, we typically think of this as white Midwesterners coming to the West Coast, but there was also a way for African-American travelers to know safe places that they could stop on the route.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a very different experience for travelers who were not white. For African-American travelers, there was something called the Green Book, which was a list of motels, restaurants, private homes, just places that were friendly to people of color. And it was immensely helpful for those people who are making the journey. It also listed places where African-Americans should not go, like sundown towns and other places where it just was not safe. And that's why we're so excited to be at Clifton's tonight, our event in downtown L.A. From 4 to 9. Clifford Clifton, when he opened his series, our chain of cafeterias in L.A., he had two rules. Everyone can eat no matter if they can pay, and everyone's allowed in. All of his sites were listed on the Green Book, including the one we will be at tonight. And so we're super excited to be there to not only go to an amazing bar, we're going to be taking over the Tiki Bar, but also to celebrate that part of history that a lot of people don't know.
That's great. We're talking with the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Jason Clement, that nonprofit organization seeking National Historic Trails status, which would provide ongoing protections for Route 66. Coincidentally, Charles in Inglewood wanted to talk about this issue of African-American travel on the Mother Road. Charles, thank you for joining us.
Larry, thank you. And it's ironic that you brought up these issues that you did at just now. As a child, in 1959, my parents traveled from Pennsylvania to Los Angeles across Route 66, and it was very much our experience that while it is a wonderful highway that should be maintained for historical purposes within our country, it still had its challenges, particularly with regard to people of color, as it came down to accommodations for either sleep and or food. As I recall from a child, oftentimes we had to divert ourselves off the road to go stay with people who we might have found through a church affiliation or something of that nature, just so we'd have a place to stay for the night.
Yeah, yeah. And so, there are two things, one of which is the psychological toll that takes, of course. The other is just as a practical matter, it makes it a totally different trip if you're always, having to detour to find a place that'll take you in. And did your parents talk, particularly in 59, I think you said your folks came, did they talk about what that was like?
And that's, you just talked about the psychological toll. The interesting thing is that, no, my parents did not talk about it, and I doubt if many other people who have a similar experience had parents who talked about it, because the purpose, one of the things that our parents tried to do is to keep, that was to avoid us from having to even know that these kinds of issues were issues that they were confronting as they were traveling, because they wanted us to have a better life. That's why they were coming west. In the search of a place where we wouldn't have to deal with the other issues that were related to color in other parts of the country.
Charles, so timely, your call. Really, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. Plus, you got a great radio voice. Thanks, Charles. Nice to have you aboard. Matt in Sherman Oaks says, I've done the route a few times with my family. Oatman, Arizona, always standing out. Boy, that road to Oatman is incredible. In fact, with early cars, they had to back it up. They had drivers who'd be on the side of the road. You'd hire them to back your car up the steep mountain to Oatman because the transmissions couldn't handle driving front ways up to Oatman. But the town is still there, a tourist attraction. I'll never forget the Floridians who were still physically shaking, who were in the store next to us in Oatman, who had made the trip. It's hair-raising, but a great one outside of Needles there and Kingman to go up to Oatman. Donkeys still walking the streets there. Jason, thank you so much for coming in and talking about it again. You'll be Clifton's Republic tonight, 4 to 9 o'clock, downtown Los Angeles. Then tomorrow at the terminus of Route 66, Mel's Drive-In, the old Penguin Coffee Shop, which has been restored as a diner after being a dental office for many years. Mel's Drive-In, 5 to 9 o'clock tomorrow in Santa Monica.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Wish you all the best with this.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another Air Talk on 89.3. Speaking of great history, Chinatown, the classic 1974 film. Our next Film Week screening Saturday night, historic Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, right near Clifton's, by the way. We'll be at Theater at Ace. We have just a few tickets left. We are nearly sold out. Go to kpcc.org/in-person. I hope to see you there Saturday night, 7 o'clock. Screenwriter Robert Towne joining me after the film.